my fifth birthday next year.
I can't wait to join university next year, and I'm working hard to score good grades for a government scholarship.
I plan to double my business by next year.
I am looking forward to a good harvest and a food-secure family next year.
I plan to elect a leader who will represent our concerns in parliament next year.
I plan to promote development in my area once re-elected next year.
But wait a minute. What if there's violence in the forthcoming elections? Won't all our dreams be shattered?
Everyone has a dream to live a better, peaceful life this election. Choose peace!
This message is brought to you by the Uganda Media Development Foundation.
On the surface, everything seems normal at the Ochiba Primary School. The kids seem energetic and the teachers seem, well, like teachers.
Oh no, oh no, oh no.
What you can't see, though, is a hidden threat, crouched like a lion hiding in the high weeds. That threat, famine.
In our home, there is hunger. Our neighbors, we share them with the little which we get.
At our home, there's famine. Sometimes we eat food once in a day. And in our neighbors, even there's a hunger.
Because of the famine, we are facing hunger.
Famine isn't some abstract concept for these three students, all seventh graders at Ochiba School, nor is it abstract for their classmates. According to the school's director of studies, Izala Kennedy. He says that of Ochiba's 950 kids, about 100 aren't showing up each day because they're too hungry for school or because they're somehow trying to fill their stomachs.
It's right, we talked right now, some are loitering outside looking for food, which they may get by means of stealing in auto view.
Kennedy says that even if hungry kids do make it to school, it's hard for them to perform.
When you go to the class, as you teach, their mind is not reasoning the way they should be reasoning. And a very simple question you pose to them, they may fail to answer it because their mind is not ready to catch up with what you teach.
The hunger at school, of course, merely reflects the famine in the community. One local government official, District Vice Chairman Sabo Camilo, confirmed that 26 have died as a result of the famine in the two districts around Arua. The official says the famine, which has worsened since the start of the year, is quite widespread, but he had no estimate on how many are sick or hospitalized as a result. Camilo blames the famine on a four-year drought. He says his office can't do much.
And we have been receiving some people who come from the communities and thinking here we are giving out food. They come to us and we cannot help them. We don't have anything to help them as local government. And this disaster is quite a disaster, and it is beyond what the local governments can be able to afford.
In part due to local government inaction, Ochiba School's Kennedy predicts the famine will worsen. And that means life will get more desperate in northwest Uganda. Seventh grader Xavier Dradriga.
We have neighbors there at home. They sleep without even taking anything. And even us, I don't take breakfast at home.
For Xavier and his friends, no breakfast is often the prelude to no lunch either, since the school ran out of money for lunches about 3 years ago. The local government official is promising action, mostly distributing seeds. For kids at Ochiba School and their neighbors, the help can't come soon enough. In July 2009, a famine had its jaws clamped tightly around Arua in northwestern Uganda. Especially hard hit, the Ochiba Primary School.
In our home, there is hunger. Our neighbors, we share them with the little which we get.
At our home, there's famine. Sometimes we eat food once in a day.
Today, things are looking up at Ochiba Primary, thanks in no small part to two Rotary clubs half a world apart. The first Rotary Club in Parkville, Missouri, sprang into action when they heard about the famine at Ochiba. They immediately donated $1,000 to start a school lunch program. Before the funds ran out, Ochiba Administrator Izala Kennedy says the school lunches made a tremendous difference.
We found there were changes because those children who used to go home and come back hungry were able to spend their lunch around and then get food from here and get organized and also attend their afternoon lessons.
Seventh grader Harriet Asiru agrees, noting that the Parkville Rotary's gift was sorely needed.
Yes, most of the children, only few can understand. When they are hungry, they cannot understand what teacher have already shared.
While the Parkville, Missouri Rotary provided the funds, the Arua, Uganda Rotary volunteered valuable time, along with donating cooking utensils and an oven. Arua Rotary President Alex Matua says the Ochiba School Lunch Project provided more than food.
When this program started, it actually gave hope to the stakeholders. Here we're talking about the students. They were able to report to school early because they know there's something. And they're also able to stay longer in school.
Seeing the impact, the Parkville, Missouri Rotary Club recently decided to renew the school lunch program with another $1,000 donation. Ochiba officials say the latest donation, combined with funds from parents, will provide lunches for about 3 months for Ochiba's 1,000 students. Still, the need goes on. Ochiba's Kennedy says 40% of the school's kids don't get enough to eat. This mirrors Uganda as a whole, where 9 million, or 28%, face food insecurity, according to the United Nations. The Arua Rotary's Alex Matua believes the Parkville Rotary donation may be a springboard for Ochiba School.
I'm very hopeful if the funds will probably be able to link and do something better. It can trickle down, only getting candidate class, we can probably go to P6, P5, by the time they're in P7, probably we expect a better performance and a better quality of life.
Thanks to two Rotary clubs, Ochiba students now believe a sign posted in the school's courtyard. The sign says, "We have high hopes and plans for the future." Reporting from Arua in northwestern Uganda, I'm Stephen Youngblood.
Peace and reconciliation. This is what the residents of Kigezi region, southwestern Uganda, are working towards during and after the February 2011 elections in the country. Kamusima Habwe, a small-scale businesswoman in Kamale Town, who has been mobilizing her fellow traders and how to avoid violence during and after the elections, says it's a duty of all Ugandans to promote and maintain peace.
Peace promotion and maintenance should be a responsibility of everybody. We locals can work with the Electoral Commission, police, and other authorities for the benefit of our country.
I also talked to the streets of Kisoro Town, and if it is John Bosco, resident of the area, added his voice to the call, though he says that reconciliation must be encouraged between the supporters of different political candidates, irrespective of the election results.
I believe differences and hatred can result from elections. So, for peace and development to be seen, people must be helped to reconcile after elections.
However, Dr. Miriam Atembe, head of the National Task Force for the Inter-Religious Council of Uganda, in charge of Kigezi and Ankole regions, says peace can prevail once stakeholders, especially religious leaders, play an active role in its promotion.
You know very well that election violence, conflict have been a feature in this country for a long time. 2001 up to these days, we cannot continue to be spectators where the people of God are suffering because of electoral processes.
Reporting, I am Otewa Lynette Rachel, a peace journalist in Kigezi region.
Moving in the heart of Gulu Town, one would think all that the business people care about is how to make as much profits. However, just like other citizens, they have national interests at heart. It is the one reason all the business communities in northern Uganda have come under an umbrella organization called Northern Uganda Business Forum for Peace to fight a cause for a peaceful elections in 2011. With the impacts of the LRA war that lasted 2 decades still fresh in their minds, Northern Uganda Business Business Forum for Peace is more than willing to use even the power of their money to have a peaceful electoral process for Uganda in 2011, as Mark Moro, their chairperson, explains.
The business community, as one of the main key players in consolidating peace in northern Uganda, money can produce both negative activities and can also produce positive activities. But now we want the money to actually produce a peaceful and prosperous election.
David Dimola, the spokesperson of Northern Uganda Business Forum for Peace, says as Northern Uganda recovers from the effects of the LRA war, people should see development programs like an egg in the hand and make decisions that help protect it through peaceful elections.
We see the business community as the most delicate component of the reconstruction program. It's like the egg. If you don't look after the egg, the chicks are not going to hatch.
Dimola urges people not to take actions that help fulfill their interests only today, but does that help favor development in the long run?
Now, we need to wise up and say, okay, election is only a one-day thing. It's for you to elect your leaders. You know, let's not make it as a forum for creating permanent enmity between the various groups. Let us not make it an occasion for us to start tearing down the pillars of development in our own community.
Uganda will hold general elections starting on the 18th of February 2011, with majority of the citizens expressing hope for a peaceful process, unlike at the start. Reporting for Radio Ruping, Lekuru Grace in Gulu Town.
Welcome to Karamoja. It's only 3 weeks left for general elections to be held in Uganda. Though there is fear from a cross-section of people that there will be violence, many are working so hard to prevent violence before and after elections. I reached some streets and villages in Moroto, one of the biggest towns in Karamoja sub-region, and asked some people how they tend to prevent violence. Seated near the road and breaking stones is Namoy. If I find people disagreeing and fighting due to politics, I talk to them. If they don't listen to me, I walk away because I might be tempted to be involved. Meanwhile, I caught up with Longo Pascal, a youth in Moroto, and he had this to say.
I engage my fellow youth members in constructive dialoguing, doing civic education of the masses whenever I have time to join groups in villages, reminding them of their role in elections and how important it's for them to respect the decision of each and every candidate to offer themselves in leadership.
On the other side, Mr. Anwar George, an elder in Acholi Inn, says,
preventing violence before and after election is normally something very, very difficult. In case you go around and you meet them confronting themselves, you try to separate, others may say, no, I think I'm on the right path. But if one accepts to listen to us elders, then it is very easy to separate them in case they are fighting or they are quarreling. But however, to be on a safer side, it is just better to go to the authority if they don't listen to you.
From the views you've just listened to, it's very clear that Ugandans are looking towards having a non-violent election. Reporting from Moroto, I'm Blessed Kathy Comfort.
My home is here in Chinjojo. I'm 14 years old. I'm an orphan. I take care of my 5 brothers and sisters. I'm the oldest. My mom died. My father killed her. My father killed himself.
When Ugandan journalist Betty Mujungu first recorded these words a few weeks ago, she never realized the life-changing impact her report would have. Betty's report, about 6 orphans struggling to survive, is too sentimental for a Hallmark card, too dramatic for Hollywood. Yet it's an important reminder that radio announcers and journalists here in Uganda can, for a change, be a force for good in their communities. Betty's odyssey began with a recent visit to an isolated shack in western Uganda, about 45 minutes from Fort Portal. There, she met 6 orphans who had been living alone for 13 months. Their home? A tiny mud brick shanty with a leaky, rusty tin roof. 14-year-old Annette took care of the younger kids.
I'm not going to school. We are suffering. We don't have food. Our relatives do not help us.
During their 13 months alone, Betty discovered that the orphans fought a constant battle for medical care and food. Betty interviewed 9-year-old Violet.
I see you crying. What's wrong?
I am hungry.
Betty says she had a hard time controlling her emotions as the orphans told their story.
It was really sad because I personally felt very touched, almost put down tears, because these girls and boys, as they were talking to me, they were sobbing, and I really felt touched.
A day after the interview, Betty's report was broadcast across Western Uganda on Life FM, based in Fort Portal. Betty says the reaction to the report was swift and gratifying.
I was surprised because when I aired this report on air on radio, people got so touched. People gave me calls. People wanted to know what exactly happened. And I really got another report about it. And the children talked about themselves and what they were going through.
In fact, 10 sympathetic listeners called the station and donated food and clothes for the children. So far, so good, though the orphans still needed some place to stay. This is when the story takes a personal turn for Betty and her mother.
When I came to my mom, explained to her, told her, these kids, look, they are like this and this, she felt it was important to bring them and offer whatever she can.
Yes, Betty's mother, 51-year-old Edith Bofunji, decided to take in the orphans, all 6 of them.
I grew up as an orphan and know what orphans go through. So I believe that God is going to provide in always.
For the orphans, life is 1,000 times better living with Betty and Edith. Still, there are challenges. The only income coming into the house is Betty's small radio station salary. There is no electricity. The children have been traumatized and are alarmingly quiet and sedate. Smiles seem in short supply, even when the kids are singing for a visitor. Also, the kids seem to constantly cling to one another. Still, even with these problems and behind the children's defenses, it's clear to see that they are very grateful to Betty and Edith.
I'm really happy because I've now got a parent. I'm an orphan. My father killed my mom, but I'm getting a parent who is going to look after me.
That's 9-year-old Violet. Her sister Annette agrees.
But now I'm okay. Every workers, I hope I may go to school.
Annette's dream of attending school is one shared by all the orphans. Yet, even with a new home, this dream seemed out of reach. School here isn't free. The cost of uniforms and fees for all 6 kids is $250, much more than Betty can afford. However, after hearing the orphan's story, a donor who wishes to remain anonymous stepped forward. He gave Betty $250 to pay for the kids' uniforms and fees this term. The donor has also committed to paying for the kids' schooling in the future. 13-year-old Janet has big plans for her education. She's going to be a teacher. Annette also has lofty goals.
I'm now happy because I'm going back to school. I'm so happy. I will become a doctor when I complete my schooling.
These kids originally lived in isolated Western Uganda in Kayanjojo district before they were rescued by Betty, her mother Edith, and some Good Samaritans. Most of all, these kids were saved by the power of Betty's radio reporting. Anyone who doubts the potential of radio here in Uganda to change lives need only talk to 7-year-old Patrick.
Here we eat, we get soap for washing clothes, and we are smart. At least we see there is some future, there is some hope that we can be okay and be children and look like any other child.
As you leave the kids' new home, you'll often find them behind the house, tending to 3 cows or a boisterous rooster. The orphans are quiet, as usual. Maybe they're pondering their good fortune in being interviewed and having their story told by Betty Mujungu. Reporting from Fort Portal in Western Uganda, I'm Stephen Youngblood.
Good morning, I'm Bill Anderson. It's great to have you listening to the Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. Coming up later this hour, find out how fellow Kansas Cityans are beating the heat, or actually avoiding the heat, and we hope to hear from you. And I'd especially like to talk to a roofer or a road builder or someone who's out in this out in the elements for 8+ hours a day. Frankly, I don't know how you do it. But first, I think you're going to be impressed and intrigued by our studio guest. They're both students at Park University. They're part of a journalism project tied to efforts to improve the prospects for peace in the world. Emphasis is put on both story selection and the way in which it's reported without compromising the principles of good journalism. I'd like to say good morning to Keith Taylor.
Good morning to you, and thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, and welcome back to the States. Joining us a little bit later will be Andy Enns. She's also a Park University student. Got a little bit lost on the way to the studios, if at least that's what I've been told. Let me read an excerpt, Keith, from your professor's blog. Stephen Youngblood writes, and talking about Uganda, "As I peered out at the Ugandan radio journalist in my peace journalism class, a class you were attending, I came to the stark realization that they're literally in a position to make life and death decisions. Radio in this part of the world is that important, that influential. The wrong word said, the wrong way, at the wrong time, can and have led to violence, even death." Now, did you feel the weight of that sitting out there in that classroom and being on the ground in Uganda?
You know, actually, in Uganda, it's hard to picture that, because the people that you meet there and the journalists there, everyone's so nice.
Uh-huh.
But it's hard to imagine that these people can get that animated about things like that. But we've seen that with the history with hate radio in Rwanda and what happened in Kenya recently. And so you know that it's real, but it seems really bizarre to meet these people who are so kind and welcoming and sincere that they could animate violence like that, or that people there could be that violent.
Let's back up a little bit. You were there for 18 days, and it was this summer, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just got back, actually.
You just got back. So where did you land in Uganda, and take us from there?
You actually land in Entebbe, which is about 20 miles south of Kampala, and their sister cities, and it's the former capital of Uganda. And then you drive from there into Kampala, and it's about 20 miles, like I said. So you'd think it'd take about 30 minutes tops. It takes about an hour and a half.
Why is that?
Because the roads in Uganda are notoriously bad. They have serious issues with the roads and keeping them repaired, and just tarmacking and blacktopping roads. So that, and we landed at night, so there's also no lights on the road, and there's dozens of people on the sides of the roads and really bad traffic, and it's quite a frightening experience when
people,
you first
people
land.
Are walking about. That's
yeah,
what's going on.
We landed on Friday night, also, so there's people walking up and down the roads because it's the most direct route, and there's shops all along the roads, and then there's the botas, which are small motorcycles, which are weaving in and out of traffic and people and going the wrong direction, and it's really hectic. It's quite a first experience. That, and when we landed in Entebbe, we walked out of the airport, and we got maybe 10 feet away from the airport, and this loud snap, and all the lights around us went off. It was just completely black, because the power infrastructure is really bad. So the power is constantly cycling on and off.
Pretty amazing. Now,
yeah.
So Kampala is about has a population of about 1.2 million, something like that.
Yes.
Uganda is a poor nation. It's probably one of the least developed nations in Africa. Massive poverty, illiteracy, violence, even corrupt governmental bodies. So you had a firsthand look when you arrived at a community that probably the tourist buses will never visit. Can you tell us about that?
Well, as far as the corruption part of it, a lot of it you see, and a lot of the complaints you hear from the journalists are that the money that will get allocated to do stuff like build roads, which is something they need, will get, you know, every person who it passes by will take a little bit of it, will take a piece of it, and it ends up being not enough to do anything with. And that's a big problem, and voting fraud and unfair elections are another big problem. But What was the other part of the
taxi driver escort you into what was called a working class neighborhood?
Yes. Go
ahead.
Our first day there was Professor Youngblood, who was in charge of us while we were there. He wanted to keep us awake so we didn't suffer from jet lag, and also kind of a bit of a culture shock, or to help deal with the culture shock. He decided that he'd have our driver, Taboo, who was a really nice guy, who was Steve's driver. He was going to take us on a tour of Kampala, and not like a highlights tour. So we went straight into this, as Steve put it, it could charitably be called a working class neighborhood. And these were, dirt roads, dirt floor houses, basically shacks. And what struck me about it was how well-dressed everyone was and seemingly clean and happy everyone was. It was very strange. You expect people to despair and be unhappy, but everyone was very upbeat and warm and welcoming, like I said.
I think it's safe to say Professor Youngblood likes to challenge his students.
Yes.
Sounds like quite a character, and we'll get into that a little bit later. I think your work reflects the serious nature of your class assignments. And I want to play a piece from a report you did, Keith. I don't know if it needs any setup, but essentially it details the threat of violence as elections approach. Do we need to hear more about that?
Basically, this is I believe this is from Gulu. It's on the streets of Gulu, and we're just trying to talk to some people who live in downtown Gulu and see if they think election or violence is going to happen during the election.
Let's listen.
I went out onto the streets of Gulu to see if people were worried about violence during the 2011 elections.
I believe that the next year's elections won't be very peaceful. There's going to be some violent aspect of it. Why? Simply because we lack political tolerance.
Everyone I spoke with declined to give their name, but they all thought violence would be an issue.
So this time we are so scared, though we need change. We still think that violence will come in, or else they may not give us the right results.
One person said he thought violence was likely, but that he hoped people would take steps to prevent it.
People should keep cool. I think people should join up hands to make sure there's no violence, not only police, even with the public.
I talked to Johnson Kalima, Gulu's regional police spokesman, and asked what steps the police were taking to prevent violence.
As I talk now, the police are training some policemen for anti-riots. But for us, we hope that the election is going to be peaceful, because the DPC group is moving around talking to members of the public, because we don't want violence in any election.
He also said 5,000 new police were being recruited all over Uganda just for the election.
Well, Keith Taylor, we just played an excerpt from that. There is more. You want to finish the story?
I believe next we talk to what's called a DRC, and I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but it's basically an elected official, like similar to a mayor. But so we talked to him about what's being done and if they're working with members of the opposition or the other party to try and help prevent violence, because it's strange that everyone you talk to, they say they expect violence, they assume that it's going to happen, but obviously nobody wants violence. So it's just kind of a challenge of how to get that out there, that everybody's on the same. We can't agree on politics, but we know we don't want anybody to die because of this.
Yes.
So I
have to believe this was a pretty tough assignment. I would suspect – I know that some people wouldn't identify themselves by name, and I suspect a lot of people just simply said no.
Yeah, well, quite a few people actually refused to even talk to us, and then no one will give their names out of fear of being – arrested should the story get heard by officials there or anything like that.
Well, a report just came out today talking about one of the most vicious rebel groups known to Uganda. They've basically been chased out into the Republic of Congo, but they've killed at least 255 people over the past 18 months. It's called the Lord's Resistance Army. Obviously, they didn't have a presence in Uganda, but their presence is still felt.
And actually, when we were in Uganda, or in Gulu, in northern Uganda, it's one of the areas that was most affected by the LRA.
Uh-huh.
And that's where they mainly operated. And there was a civil war there, and I believe it was 20 or so years. And it's just ended recently, and the expectation for violence and hostility comes from what they've gone through with that, and they're still recovering from that, and there's orphans, and they deal with this on a daily basis, this kind of fallout from this war that they all went through.
Well, I was even looking at the tweets of a journalist. I want to say his name is, I may be mispronouncing this, Tim Galyegira. He's been writing about last month's bombings in Kampala. It took 80 lives, and he actually was arrested for some of the stuff he's posted on his website. He picked up by the police a few times, and his latest tweet that I saw simply said, "Been in and out of police stations for a week." So there's always that threat, and the journalists are always probably looking behind their shoulders. And I would guess you have to be a pretty strong-willed person, otherwise you might compromise your reporting. Did you have any of those kind of conversations with the Ugandan journalist you were with?
I didn't personally, but during the seminars, when Professor Youngblood is teaching these seminars, one of the things he talks to him about is you know that the government wants to keep you from criticizing them. You know that they're basically just looking for a reason to keep you off the air. So don't give it to them. He encourages them to be transparent and to be open about where they get their information if they can. To try to get people to go on the record and give their names and be open about how they get all their information. So that's one of the things that he does to try and to keep them from, so they can say, look, we didn't do anything wrong. We're just being arrested, wrongly. We're being imprisoned wrongly.
I'm Bill Anderson. Thanks for listening. Ahead, how your neighbors are beating the heat, and we hope to hear your stories. Right now, we're talking about a trip two Park College University students made to Uganda. They were participating in a peace journalism project, and we need to talk about that. And they even ate ants for the first time, and we'll get into that as well as the hour progresses. Now joining us is Andy Enns. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
And you were over there at the same time as Keith, and you just got back to the States.
Yep.
Good experience? Heavy experience?
It was amazing. It's impossible to put into words, which, is probably not something a journalist should ever say. But it was one of it completely changed my life, and I know that already, and I don't even know how to formulate that into words.
You're still figuring that
out? I'm still figuring it out,
yeah.
I came home and ended up adding journalism as a second major. I went over there as a public relations major, and I came back and added journalism, and it's just
This was her first time out of the country, actually.
Seriously.
Yeah. I've been all over the States, but I'd never been out of the country before. And all my friends said I was really dramatic for not choosing somewhere like Europe to go first.
What an exciting adventure. So. Yeah, not exactly Rome. Yeah,
no Mexico, no Bahamas, straight to Uganda.
Well, Andy, you did some reporting while you were over there as well. But first, I want to talk a little bit about this concept of peace journalism. Let's start with you, Andy. Define that for us.
Peace journalism is based around the idea that editors and journalists make choices with their words, and you can either make a choice to be inflammatory with your words, or you can make the choice to just be really straightforward and facilitate unemotional talks about what's going on. So you can either use words like massacre and genocide that most people don't even know what the specific definition is, or you can just say, well, this many people were killed and this is what happened and these are what, experts are saying we can do about it.
Keith?
Yeah, what I'd add to that is this, it's like she's saying with the word choice, and that's one thing that's focused on a lot is like a massacre, how many people have to be killed for it to be a massacre. And Professor Youngblood does this. He asks the journalist, is it 10? Is it 20? Is it 50? What's a massacre? What's a slaughter?
Mm-hmm.
So, these are imprecise words. Don't use them. The only point of them is to get people emotional and to get them excited. And this is the kind of thing that incites violence, whether it's that's the purpose of it, or that's just the byproduct of it. So we try to talk to journalists, and this is what we've learned, is to you just use the number, you just use the facts, and if it's a tragedy or if it's an awful thing, people are going to understand that without you telling them that it's a tragedy or that it's awful. You don't need to put that emotion in there.
Stay true to the principles of good journalism, essentially.
And that's what a lot of it is. It's just good, solid, basic journalism.
Keith Taylor is here. So is Andy Enns. And you can be here. Phone 235-2888, 235-2888, or email the show, waltbodineshow@kcur.org. We're on Twitter and Facebook, too. Andy, you filed a pretty heavy report. It was difficult to listen to just because of the intensity of it and the circumstance for this woman. Basically, your report was on landmines. We're going to hear a bit of it, but will you set it up for us?
Yeah, I went out with a team of peace journalists from the seminar that we did in Gulu, northern Uganda. And we went out to their center for disabled people, and this woman, you never would have known that she was disabled. She had a prosthetic leg that was like her exact same skin color as her other leg. But it was once that she started talking that, you know, that I realized what was going on.
Okay, well, we're going to give a listen now.
Standing inside a small hair salon in the Gulu district of northwestern Uganda, you would never know your stylist was disabled unless she told you her story.
My first step on the ground, I step on mine. Then I was blown by landmine. I fell down. I could not even know myself.
Landmine survivors, like Irene Lackey, often have amputated limbs as a result of the accident.
But still, I don't want people to see my leg. Even going out in toilet, I just find it difficult because I don't want anyone to see me with my disability.
As if being the victim of a landmine explosion isn't enough, survivors report rejection from their loved ones following the incident.
Andy, that must have been tough.
It was. It was a really new experience for me to bear witness to that kind of story. Previously, I mean, on campus, I've always done like really positive, like happy human interest, nothing that was nearly that deep.
And if I have it correct, if I'm recalling the report accurately, you went on to say that this woman's fiance dumped her because of her disability?
Yeah, she was still in the hospital. She was recovering from the surgery where they amputated her leg, and he came in and said, I can't be with you anymore because you're ugly. And then when she was upset, his best friend even also came to the hospital and reiterated.
Mm-hmm. So the landmines, I mean, are they pretty much everywhere?
They were during the war. There's not too many landmine explosions anymore. They've pretty much found them all. But at the time, it was really common. Well, what she told me about her story was the LRA actually came through and planted landmines on people's doorsteps. When they walked outside, they didn't even know they were there.
Mm. Let's change direction here momentarily, let's add some levity. I want to talk about the spoiled taste of ants. That's how Stephen Youngblood, your professor, described the taste of this little snack. Andy, I think you refused to participate, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I volunteered to do it. I was like, well, I'll take one for the team. But Keith and Steve told me that I should be smart and not do it. So, you know, I wasn't too unhappy about not participating.
Keith, you don't look like a foolish guy to me.
You know, it was all about new experiences while I was there. And that was part of the whole thing. And figured, why not? And yeah, I wouldn't do it again.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. It's basically like eating sand it's hard to explain. It's very unpleasant taste and it stick in your teeth. And I knew it was going to be bad when I pulled out the little half dozen or so that I ate, and there was a trail of legs going down my fingers.
That's usually a bad sign.
Not pleasant.
Yeah. Hey, what was the most pleasant surprise you had while you were in Uganda?
I think how friendly everyone was. Like, I was really surprised because, you know, I'm, you know, this geeky white kid from Missouri, you know, in their country. And they welcomed me with open arms and definitely, you know, they helped us, like, learn their customs and seemed really gracious about the whole thing.
Yeah, Keith, you're smiling.
That's the biggest thing. I think that's what anybody would notice. It's shocking how positive and hopeful and friendly everyone is. And it's not just you think that it might just be a culture shock or maybe where we were, but it's genuinely everywhere we went, every person we talked to was hospitable and nice. When you go into someone's house, they bring you in and they sit you down and they offer you tea and food, and even if they don't have it. And I talked to some of the journalists about this also, and they said that even when their friends show up, if they're cooking for themselves, they'll give their friends their food and go back and cook again. It's just how they're expected to be that way.
And you had the pleasure of being invited to a wedding, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about that, Andy.
It was so long, and I mean, our weddings, I think Professor Youngblood put it in a really good term, that he said that our weddings are really similar to funerals. Like, that's our closest thing in our cultures, because they're really somber ceremonies. Over there, everyone's laughing, dancing. They hired a comedian to run the show.
Nice.
It was fun. And even though we didn't share language, you know, it was still a great time.
English is the official language.
English is the official language, uh-huh. But for the tribal wedding, they were speaking in Buganda, which is their tribal language.
Yeah, okay. This was a traditional tribal wedding, and they're actually called an introduction. And it's supposed to be the first time that the groom meets the bride's family. And so the groom's family comes in, and there's like a moderator who's doing like a negotiation, basically, is what it seems like. Again, we didn't speak the language, so it's hard. But the whole time it's very joking and lighthearted, and the bride's family, like all the cousins and aunts and uncles, come dancing out to music. And it's kind of like the way we had it explained to us was that it's like, are you sure you want to be part of this family? Do you see these people? Do you really want to be part of this family?
Talk about being put on the spot.
And the bride has to search for the groom. He hides among his family, and the bride has to come out and search for him. And it was very entertaining. And everyone's dressed very beautifully, and they have these
– in a colorful manner.
Yeah, these traditional dresses with big shoulders and huge bows on the front of them, and it's very beautiful ceremony.
Yeah, and you had to drive to get there. Was that an adventure in itself?
We were actually taking Andy to the airport. That was the day she was leaving, and so
she thought.
Yeah, it was off the Entebbe Road, so it was on the way to the airport, and it was maybe 15 or 20 minutes off the road, and these are basically single track or double track like dirt roads with huge potholes, and if it rained, they'd be impassable. The roads are just a disaster. So everybody's in these beautiful dresses, and it's dusty, and it's just – and it started to rain a little, and it was quite an experience.
You're listening to The Walt Bodine Show on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson. It's great to have you with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, 235-2888. That's 235-2888. Email reaches the show, waltbodineshow@kcur.org. A little bit later in the hour, Brian Busby, chief meteorologist for Channel 9, joins us, and we want to hear about how you're beating the heat this summer during this heat wave. Keith, I want to play another clip. It's a report you did on the education system, and you visited a specific school. Set that up for us, and then let's hear it.
It's called the LaRue Boarding School, I believe, and it's just outside of Gulu. It's maybe 10 minutes outside of Gulu or in Gulu, and their purpose is to work with orphans who were children who were orphaned by the war that just ended there, and it was a really special school and had a lot of promise.
Let's listen.
These familiar sounds of children at play are coming from an unfamiliar setting. Here at the LaRue Boarding Primary School, the teachers and administrators have the difficult and unique task of working with children affected by the war. Deputy Headmaster Kilama Odwong Jakantis explained the situations facing some of the 460 students here, ranging in ages from 6 to 20 years old.
There were some who were born in captivity, but their mother killed during crossfire. So they were rescued without knowing now where their mother is and where their father is.
The school was established in 2006 by the Belgium and Ugandan governments. And adding to the challenges of the students here, the school faces challenges of its own.
They said we were to wait for a curriculum from Kenya. this kind of war was there. They fought, and after the war, they started a similar school in Kenya. We waited, the curriculum did not come. Then they said we had to wait for a curriculum from Sierra Leone. We waited, no curriculum. Then, just from within, we said, no, we cannot wait any longer. We brought in the normal primary school curriculum of Uganda, and we are now operating on that.
Funding is another problem that affects everything at the school. It even affects whether some students will get to return.
One has to be pretty determined to get an education currently in Uganda.
It seems that way. And what I was getting ready to the segment or the part I was going into there was that because they don't have the funding to get children to the school, some of them will even have to walk or hitchhike back. And so many students who can't make it back just never return after once the year ends or the session ends. So that's a problem there also. And it's really sad because this. You see this compound and the way it was built, and it's clear that they had this very specific idea and how positive this could have been. And they're still doing good work, but somewhere between the planning and the idea with the corruption and the way that money gets mishandled there, that it just got lost track of. And like the director was saying, that there's no curriculum for the school. So they're operating on a standard school curriculum, and they're dealing with children who also have – many of them have been raised in captivity or born in captivity, and that's something I had never even thought about before, the fact that a person can be born in captivity. So it's very strange circumstances.
That's Keith Taylor. He's a student at Park University, recently traveled to Uganda as part of a peace journalism project. And Andy Enns is here. She did the same thing, her very first trip out of the country, all the way to Uganda. I have to ask this as a parent, your folks, were they pretty nervous about this?
They were really nervous, and I was just glad that I managed to make it out of the States before the bombing in Kampala, because I think if the bombing had happened before I left, they wouldn't have let me go.
Yeah, that was so unfortunate, and that was just a few, last month, actually. Agriculture is a pretty big part of the Ugandan economic engine. But Mother Nature, at least in parts of the country, hasn't exactly been kind. You did a report on drought, and why don't you set that up, and I'd like to listen to an excerpt from that.
All right. In northern Uganda, I went out with a team, and we went to this village, and it was, I don't know, it was half an hour out of town, and they had never seen a foreigner in their village before, ever. And so that was an experience just in itself. And eventually we discovered that they hadn't had water in their village for 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, they walk into town, they walk miles into town to buy dirty water because that's all they can afford.
Uh-huh. And then they boil the water, I'm assuming?
I don't think they do.
Hmm.
What they had sitting around wasn't boiled. And they didn't have any, unless they built a fire, they didn't have any way to boil water.
No, waterborne diseases are a big problem there. Typhoid and hepatitis A and also just the bacterial infections that cause diarrhea, they're a huge problem. They kill possibly hundreds of thousands of children there every year. So it's you know, just things that simple salt pills could solve. That they have that problem there.
Well, why don't we listen to Andy's segment from Andy's report.
After a long day of farming the potato-like cassava, from digging them up to scraping the dirt off, nothing sounds as great as an icy cold gulp of water. Unfortunately for the villagers of the Kolo area of northwestern Uganda, their thirst goes unquenched. Here is what one Kolo resident has to say.
The issue of water was number one. That there is only one borehole and so many people have to get water from that borehole.
The local wells are dry, having been overextended when the area was an internally displaced persons camp, according to the Honorable Agnes Pilar, elected to represent youth in the district.
There's no good clean source of water there. So there's need to be taken where people are going back there.
While the Honorable Pilar agrees that water supply is a primary concern in the community, she says the district government relies on nonprofit organizations to help solve the problem. Agnes Pilar.
So we are even requesting this new coming government and even other NGOs to support our villages to go and look for a good source for water.
However, the solution isn't any easier for nonprofits to supply.
Well, in Uganda is known for having great soil and generally favorable climate, but obviously there's been a downturn, at least in one part of the country.
Yes, definitely. And even more, I mean, their plantation there was really lush, but they didn't have anything to drink. There was mud everywhere, which was really ironic considering that there was nothing for them. You know, there was no way for them to get hydration.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and the part of the country you were in, what are the main crops?
In the village that we were in, it was tapioca, which looks like potatoes, and peanuts.
Really? I know they grow a lot of cotton, tobacco, plantains, probably corn. Mm-hmm. Generally, it's an agriculturally rich country.
A lot of tea also.
A lot of tea?
Yes.
And coffee, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. I have to ask you, do you plan to go back as part of the Park University project, or was your experience there limited to just this year?
Our experience is limited there. Uh-huh. Our professor is staying there through April, but I know for me personally, I vow to go back someday. My life will not be complete unless I do.
Yeah, your life has changed. You said that earlier, and I find that so fascinating. So you're still kind of reflecting on this and trying to figure out what it all means.
Yes, definitely.
But you want to be a journalist?
You know, I'm not really sure where I want my life to go. I kept public relations, and then I added journalism as two majors. And I just know that whatever I do, I want to help those people.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Keith, how about you?
I'm not exactly sure yet, but it's definitely something that's looking more and more likely. The more I get involved with it and the more power I see that it can have this positive impact, like the work we were doing, it's hard to turn away from it.
Two words, public radio. Keep it in mind. You both have those skill sets, without a doubt. I want to ask you, that country has so many lakes, the biggest being Lake Victoria. Did you have a chance to experience and recreate a little bit?
Entebbe, where the airport is actually right on – it's right next to Lake Victoria. So you drive right by Lake Victoria to get to Kampala.
But as far as experiencing the lakes, we went out to it's near Kasese in the western part of the country, and we spent a weekend doing safari, just as a way to relax. We did this boat ride where we were, I don't know, a couple feet away from hippos and elephants, and it was really amazing.
Yeah, it's in between Lake Edward and Lake I can't remember the other lake, but there's a channel in between them, and we took this boat ride on it, and it's a couple hours long, and we saw elephants, hippos, and crocodile, or is it alligators there?
Crocodiles.
Fish.
They're all the same to me.
Yeah. Well, one of them, their teeth are inside, and I can never keep it straight. But uh-huh. We saw African fish eagles. That was a really amazing experience, being that close to animals that big. And we were actually walking down the road at one point, and we turned a corner, and there was a hippo standing in the middle of the road. I mean, these things are the size of a truck. They're huge animals.
Just a wild hippo on the range.
Just standing there eating the grass, just turned and looked at us.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty bizarre.
Did you do a photo essay by any chance, either one of you?
I took over 2,000 photos while
I
was there. So I haven't narrowed it down to, you know, my favorite few that could be a photo essay yet. Every time I look at them, I'm like, I love every photo that I took. Which may just be narcissism.
Well, let's take a phone call, and Marty's calling from Overland Park. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll make this brief because I should shut up because you got this show is so interesting that you don't really need any callers at all. But I'm curious if I've got this correct. I know you're not supposed to speak not of what you're supposed to speak not of what you know not of, and I know nothing of this. But whenever I think of Uganda, do I correctly think of Idi Amin?
Oh, wow.
Is that correct? He was a very large man who ruled the country and caused mass slaughter. Is that correct?
Yeah, he did. I can't remember if it's Uganda, to be quite honest with you, Marty.
I can't either.
And I know it's definitely in that region. We learned so many of the names and so many terrible things happened in that area.
Oh,
that
horrible.
it's really hard to keep straight which dictators and which generals were in which of those tiny countries.
Hey,
I just remember that recently he died in luxury in the south of France.
Yeah, he was actually the military dictator and president of Uganda from 71 to 79, and I thank our producer Brian Ellison for that prompt action.
Okay. Well, I'm an old guy, so you know. All right, well, I was just curious as to, I guess there's so much turmoil over there that was kind of like swept under the rug, more or less.
Yeah, with the war with the LRA and dealing with the LRA rebels, it's one tragedy after the other.
Is whether or not that was still an issue, because that's what I always think of when I think of Uganda, and I think of the tragedy of Idi Amin, and that, because that was so horrible, and I just wondered if that was still stuck in their minds, but I guess they have enough stuff to worry about without thinking back that far.
And I think that hangover does still exist, Marty. Thank you for the phone call.
You're very welcome. Keep talking.
And let's talk to Al quickly. Al, good morning.
Yes, it was Idi Amin.
Yeah.
But the question I wanted to ask is, if they, there was a forced, it wasn't genocide, but it was a forced rejection of an indigenous population. The East Indian population of Uganda was very important for the infrastructure of that country during Idi Amin's time and prior to that for roughly 3 to 5 generations. And they were driven out of Uganda. And I'm wondering if there's any of that infrastructure that you guys noticed still exists, because that was, they were, it was a tribal uprising against the Indians, the East Indian population, and they were the infrastructure of Uganda until what you saw. And so I'm wondering if you saw any remnants of that.
Through all the history that I've read and all the things that have happened there, there was also instances of the Asian population being thrown out by the king there. Also, is that what you're speaking about? You hear people talk about it, but it's not so much visible. It'd be hard to see a real visible side effect from it, with just all the other things that are the poverty and like the roads and everything else. It's hard to really say what the impact would be.
When you drive a group out like that, a large, significant group out, this is what you have. You have a complete collapse of the culture.
Al, we appreciate your phone call this morning.
Sure.
Keith Taylor and Andy Enns are students at Park University. It was really nice to have you here, and I really like the way you expressed yourself with your heartfelt feelings, and you talked honestly about your experience in Uganda. And, boy, I can tell you, you're great students and you're good people. It was nice to have you on the airwaves at KCUR.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.